She lay still, her legs stretched forward, her hands on the arms of the seat, with no sense of motion, not even her own, to give her a sense of time. With no space, no sight, no future, with the night of closed eyelids under the pressure of the cloth, and with the knowledge of his presence beside her as her single, unchanging reality. They did not speak. Once, she said suddenly, "Mr. Gault."
"Yes."
"No, nothing. I just wanted to know whether you were still there."
"I will always be there."
She did not know for how many miles the memory of the sound of words seemed like a small landmark rolling away into the distance, then vanishing. Then there was nothing but the stillness of an indivisible present. She did not know whether a day had passed or an hour when she felt the downward plunging motion, which meant that they were about to land or to crash. The two possibilities seemed equal to her mind. She felt the jolt of the wheels against the ground as an oddly delayed sensation, as if some fraction of time had gone to make her believe it. She felt the running streak of jerky motion, then the jar of the stop and of silence, then the touch of his hands on her hair removing the blindfold. She saw a glaring sunlight, a stretch of scorched weeds going off into the sky with no mountains to stop it, a deserted highway, and the hazy outline of a town about a mile away. She glanced at her watch. 47 minutes ago, she had still been in the valley.
"You'll find a Taggart station there," he said, pointing at the town, "and you'll be able to take a train."
She nodded as if she understood. He did not follow her as she descended to the ground. He leaned across the wheel toward the open door of the plane, and they looked at each other. She stood, her face raised to him, a faint wind stirring her hair, the straight line of her shoulders sculptured by the trim suit of a business executive amidst the flat immensity of an empty prairie. The movement of his hand pointed east, toward some invisible cities.
"Don't look for me out there," he said. "You will not find me. Until you want me for what I am, and when you'll want me, I'll be the easiest man to find."
She heard the sound of the door falling closed upon him. It seemed louder than the blast of the propeller that followed. She watched the run of the plane's wheels and the trail of weeds left flattened behind them. Then she saw a strip of sky between wheels and weeds. She looked around her. A reddish haze of heat hung over the shapes of the town in the distance, and the shapes seemed to sag under a rusty tinge. Above their roofs, she saw the remnant of a crumbled smokestack. She saw a dry yellow scrap rustling faintly in the weeds beside her. It was a piece of newspaper. She looked at these objects blankly, unable to make them real. She raised her eyes to the plane. She watched the spread of its wings grow smaller in the sky, draining away in its wake the sound of its motor. It kept rising, wings first, like a long silver cross. Then the curve of its motion went following the sky, dropping slowly closer to the earth. Then it seemed not to move any longer, but only to shrink. She watched it like a star in the process of extinction, while it shrank from cross to dot to a burning spark, which she was no longer certain of seeing. When she saw that the spread of the sky was strewn with such sparks all over, she knew that the plane was gone. Chapter 3. Anti-Greed. "What am I doing here?" asked Dr. Robert Stadler. "Why was I asked to come here? I demand an explanation. I'm not accustomed to being dragged halfway across a continent without rhyme, reason, or notice." Dr. Floyd Ferris smiled.
"Which makes me appreciate it all the more that you did come, Dr. Stadler."
It was impossible to tell whether his voice had a tone of gratitude or of gloating. The sun was beating down upon them, and Dr. Stadler felt a streak of perspiration oozing along his temple. He could not hold an angrily, embarrassingly private discussion in the middle of a crowd streaming to fill the benches of the grandstand around them. The discussion which he had tried and failed to obtain for the last 3 days. It occurred to him that this was precisely the reason why his meeting with Dr. Ferris had been delayed to this moment. But he brushed the thought aside, just as he brushed some insect buzzing to reach his wet temple. "Why was I unable to get in touch with you?" he asked. The fraudulent weapon of sarcasm now seemed to sound less effective than ever, but it was Dr. Stadler's only weapon. Why did you find it necessary to send me messages on official stationery worded in a style proper, I'm sure, for army orders, he was about to say, but didn't. Communications, but certainly not for scientific correspondence.
It is a government matter, said Dr. Ferris gently.
Do you realize that I was much too busy, and that this meant an interruption of my work?
Oh, yes, said Dr. Ferris noncommittally.
Do you realize that I could have refused to come?
But you didn't, said Dr. Ferris softly.
Why was I given no explanation? Why didn't you come for me in person instead of sending those incredible young hooligans with their mysterious gibberish that sounded half science, half pulp magazine?
I was too busy, said Dr. Ferris blandly.
Then would you mind telling me what you're doing in the middle of a plane in Iowa, and what I'm doing here, for that matter? He waved contemptuously at the dusty horizon of an empty prairie, and at the three wooden grandstands. The stands were newly erected, and the wood, too, seemed to perspire. He could see drops of resin sparkling in the sun.
We are about to witness an historical event, Dr. Stadler, an occasion which will become a milestone on the road of science, civilization, social welfare, and political adaptability.
Dr. Ferris's voice had the tone of a public relations man's memorized handout.
The turning point of a new era.
What event? What new era?
As you will observe, only the most distinguished citizens, the cream of our intellectual elite, have been chosen for the special privilege of witnessing this occasion. We could not omit your name, could we? And we feel certain, of course, that we can count on your loyalty and cooperation.
He could not catch Dr. Ferris's eyes. The grandstands were rapidly filling with people, and Dr. Ferris kept interrupting himself constantly to wave to nondescript newcomers, whom Dr. Stadler had never seen before, but who were personages, as he could tell by the particular shade of gaily informal deference in Ferris's waving. They all seemed to know Dr. Ferris and to seek him out, as if he were the master of ceremonies or the star of the occasion.
If you would kindly be specific for a moment, said Dr. Stadler, and tell me what?
Hi, Spud, called Dr. Ferris, waving to a portly, white-haired man who filled the full-dress uniform of a general.
Dr. Stadler raised his voice. I said, if you would kindly concentrate long enough to explain to me what in hell is going on.
But it's very simple. It's the final triumph of... You'll have to excuse me a minute, Dr. Stadler, said Dr. Ferris hastily,
tearing forward like an overtrained lackey at the sound of a bell, in the direction of what looked like a group of aging rowdies. He turned back long enough to add two words, which he seemed reverently to consider as a full explanation.
The press.
Dr. Stadler sat down on the wooden bench, feeling unaccountably reluctant to brush against anything around him. The three grandstands were spaced at intervals in a semi-curve, like the tiers of a small private circus, with room for some 300 people. They seemed built for the viewing of some spectacle, but they faced the emptiness of a flat prairie stretching off to the horizon, with nothing in sight but the dark blotch of a farmhouse miles away. There were radio microphones in front of one stand, which seemed reserved for the press. There was a contraption resembling a portable switchboard in front of the stand reserved for officials. A few levers of polished metal sparkled in the sun on the face of the switchboard. In an improvised parking lot behind the stands, the glitter of luxurious new cars seemed a brightly reassuring sight. But it was the building that stood on a knoll some 1,000 feet away that gave Dr. Stadler a vague sense of uneasiness. It was a small, squat structure of unknown purpose, with massive stone walls, no windows except a few slits protected by stout iron bars, and a large dome, grotesquely too heavy for the rest, that seemed to press the structure down into the soil. A few outlets protruded from the base of the dome, in loose, irregular shapes resembling badly poured clay funnels. They did not seem to belong to an industrial age or to any known usage. The building had an air of silent malevolence, like a puffed, venomous mushroom. It was obviously modern, but its sloppy, rounded, ineptly unspecific lines made it look like a primitive structure unearthed in the heart of the jungle, devoted to some secret rites of savagery. Dr. Stadler sighed with irritation. He was tired of secrets. Confidential and top confidential,
had been the word stamped on the invitation, which had demanded that he travel to Iowa on a 2-day notice, and for an unspecified purpose. Two young men who called themselves physicists had appeared at the Institute to escort him. His calls to Ferris's office in Washington had remained unanswered. The young men had talked, through an exhausting trip by government plane, then a clammy ride in a government car, about science, emergencies, social equilibriums, and the need of secrecy, till he knew less than he had known at the start. He noticed only that two words kept recurring in their jabber, which had also appeared in the text of the invitation. Two words that had an ominous sound when involving an unknown issue. The demands for his loyalty and cooperation. The young men had deposited him on a bench in the front row of the grandstand and had vanished like the folding gear of a mechanism, leaving him to the sudden presence of Dr. Ferris in person. Now, watching the scene around him, watching Dr. Ferris's vague, excited, loosely casual gestures in the midst of a group of newsmen, he had an impression of bewildering confusion, of senseless, chaotic inefficiency, and of a smooth machine, working to produce the exact degree of that impression needed at the exact moment. He felt a single, sudden flash of panic, in which, as in a flash of lightning, he permitted himself to know that he felt a desperate desire to escape, but he slammed his mind shut against it. He knew that the darkest secret of the occasion, more crucial, more untouchable, more deadly than whatever was hidden in the mushroom building, was that which had made him agree to come. He would never have to learn his own motive, he thought. He thought it not by means of words, but by means of the brief, vicious spasm of an emotion that resembled irritation and felt like acid. The words that stood in his mind as they had stood when he had agreed to come were like a voodoo formula which one recites when it is needed, and beyond which one must not look. What can you do when you have to deal with people? He noticed that the stand reserved for those whom Ferris had called the intellectual elite was larger than the stand prepared for government officials. He caught himself feeling a swift little sneak of pleasure at the thought that he had been placed in the front row. He turned a glance at the tiers behind him. The sensation he experienced was like a small gray shock. That random, faded, shop-worn assembly was not his conception of an intellectual elite. He saw defensively belligerent men and tastelessly dressed women. He saw mean, rancorous, suspicious faces that bore the one mark incompatible with the standard-bearer of the intellect, the mark of uncertainty. He could find no face he knew, no face to recognize as famous, and none likely ever to achieve such recognition. He wondered by what standard these people had been selected. Then he noticed a gangling figure in the second row, the figure of an elderly man with a long, slack face that seemed faintly familiar to him, though he could recall nothing about it except a vague memory, as of a photograph seen in some unsavory publication. He leaned toward a woman and asked, pointing, "Could you tell me the name of that gentleman?" The woman answered in a whisper of awed respect, "That is Dr. Simon Pritchett." Dr. Stadler turned away, wishing no one would see him, wishing no one would ever learn that he had been a member of that group. He raised his eyes and saw that Ferris was leading the whole press gang toward him. He saw Ferris sweeping his arm at him in the manner of a tourist guide, and declaring when they were close enough to be heard, "But why should you waste your time on me, when there is the source of today's achievement, the man who made it all possible, Dr. Robert Stadler?" It seemed to him for an instant that he saw an incongruous look on the worn, cynical faces of the newsmen, a look that was not quite respect, expectation, or hope, but more like an echo of these, like a faint reflection of the look they might have worn in their youth on hearing the name of Robert Stadler. In that instant, he felt an impulse which he would not acknowledge, the impulse to tell them that he knew nothing about today's event, that his power counted for less than theirs, that he had been brought here as a pawn in some confidence game, almost as a prisoner. Instead, he heard himself answering their questions in the smug, condescending tone of a man who shares all the secrets of the highest authorities. "Yes, the State Science Institute is proud of its record of public service. The State Science Institute is not the tool of any private interests or personal greed. It is devoted to the welfare of mankind, to the good of humanity as a whole. Spouting like a dictaphone the sickening generalities he had heard from Dr. Ferris. He would not permit himself to know that what he felt was self-loathing. He identified the emotion, but not its object. It was loathing for the men around him, he thought. It was they who were forcing him to go through the shameful performance. What can you do, he thought, when you have to deal with people? The newsmen were making brief notes of his answers. Their faces now had the look of automatons acting out the routine of pretending that they were hearing news in the empty utterances of another automaton. Dr. Stadler, asked one of them, pointing at the building on the knoll, is it true that you consider Project X the greatest achievement of the State Science Institute? There was a dead drop of silence. Project X, said Dr. Stadler. He knew that something was ominously wrong in the tone of his voice, because he saw the heads of the newsmen go up, as at the sound of an alarm. He saw them waiting, their pencils poised. For one instant, while he felt the muscles of his face cracking into the fraud of a smile, he felt a formless, an almost supernatural terror, as if he sensed again the silent working of some smooth machine, as if he were caught in it, part of it, and doing its irrevocable will. Project X, he said softly, in the mysterious tone of a conspirator. Well, gentlemen, the value and the motive of any achievement of the State Science Institute are not to be doubted, since it is a non-profit venture. Need I say more? He raised his head and noticed that Dr. Ferris had stood on the edge of the group through the whole of the interview. He wondered whether he imagined that the look on Dr. Ferris's face now seemed less tense and more impertinent. Two resplendent cars came shooting at full speed into the parking lot and stopped with a flourish of screeching brakes. The newsmen deserted him in the middle of a sentence and went running to meet the group alighting from the cars. Dr. Stadler turned to Ferris. What is Project X? He asked sternly. Dr. Ferris smiled in a manner of innocence and insolence together. A non-profit venture, he answered, and went running off to meet the newcomers. From the respectful whispers of the crowd, Dr. Stadler learned that the little man in a wilted linen suit who looked like a shyster, striding briskly in the center of the new group, was Mr. Thompson, the head of the state. Mr. Thompson was smiling, frowning, and barking answers to the newsmen. Dr. Ferris was weaving through the group with the grace of a cat rubbing against sundry legs. The group came closer, and he saw Ferris steering them in his direction. Mr. Thompson, said Dr. Ferris sonorously as they approached. May I present Dr. Robert Stadler? Dr. Stadler saw the little shyster's eyes studying him for the fraction of a second. The eyes had a touch of superstitious awe, as at the sight of a phenomenon from a mystical realm forever incomprehensible to Mr. Thompson. And they had the piercing, calculating shrewdness of a ward healer who feels certain that nothing is immune from his standards. A glance like the visual equivalent of the words, what's your angle? It's an honor, Doctor, an honor, I'm sure, said Mr. Thompson briskly, shaking his hand. He learned that the tall, stoop-shouldered man with a crew haircut was Mr. Wesley Mooch. He did not catch the names of the others whose hands he shook. As the group proceeded toward the official's grandstand, he was left with the burning sensation of a discovery he dared not face, the discovery that he had felt anxiously pleased by the little shyster's nod of approval. A party of young attendants, who looked like movie theater ushers, appeared from somewhere with handcarts of glittering objects, which they proceeded to distribute to the assembly. The objects were field glasses. Dr. Ferris took his place at the microphone of a public address system by the official's stand. At a signal from Wesley Mooch, his voice boomed suddenly over the prairie, an unctuous, fraudulently solemn voice, magnified by the microphone inventor's ingenuity into the sound and power of a giant. Ladies and gentlemen, the crowd was struck into silence, all heads jerking unanimously toward the graceful figure of Dr. Floyd Ferris. Ladies and gentlemen, you have been chosen in recognition of your distinguished public service and social loyalty to witness the unveiling of a scientific achievement of such tremendous importance, such staggering scope, such epoch-making possibilities, that up to this moment it has been known only to a very few, and only as Project X.
Dr. Stadler focused his field glasses on the only thing in sight, on the blotch of the distant farm. He saw that it was the deserted ruin of a farmhouse, which had obviously been abandoned years ago. The light of the sky showed through the naked ribs of the roof, and jagged bits of glass framed the darkness of empty windows. He saw a sagging barn, the rusted tower of a water wheel, and the remnant of a tractor lying upturned, with its treads in the air. Dr. Ferris was talking about the crusaders of science and about the years of selfless devotion, unremitting toil and persevering research that had gone into Project X. It was odd, thought Dr. Stadler, studying the ruins of the farm, that there should be a herd of goats in the midst of such desolation. There were six or seven of them, some drowsing, some munching lethargically at whatever grass they could find among the sun-scorched weeds.
Project X, Dr. Ferris was saying, was devoted to some special research in the field of sound. The science of sound has astonishing aspects, which laymen would scarcely suspect.
Some 50 feet away from the farmhouse, Dr. Stadler saw a structure obviously new and of no possible purpose whatever. It looked like a few spans of a steel trestle rising into empty space, supporting nothing, leading nowhere. Dr. Ferris was now talking about the nature of sound vibrations. Dr. Stadler aimed his field glasses at the horizon beyond the farm. But there was nothing else to be seen for dozens of miles. The sudden straining motion of one of the goats brought his eyes back to the herd. He noticed that the goats were chained to stakes driven at intervals into the ground.
And it was discovered, said Dr. Ferris, that there are certain frequencies of sound vibration which no structure, organic or inorganic, can withstand.
Dr. Stadler noticed a silvery spot bouncing over the weeds among the herd. It was a kid that had not been chained. It kept leaping and weaving about its mother.
The sound ray is controlled by a panel inside the giant underground laboratory, said Dr. Ferris, pointing at the building on the knoll. That panel is known to us affectionately as the xylophone, because one must be darn careful to strike the right keys, or rather to pull the right levers. For this special occasion, an extension xylophone connected to the one inside has been erected here.
He pointed to the switchboard in front of the official stand, so that you may witness the entire operation and see the simplicity of the whole procedure. Dr. Stadler found pleasure in watching the kid, a soothing, reassuring kind of pleasure. The little creature seemed barely a week old. It looked like a ball of white fur with graceful long legs. It kept bounding in a manner of deliberate, gaily ferocious awkwardness. All four of its legs held stiff and straight. It seemed to be leaping at the sun rays, at the summer air, at the joy of discovering its own existence.
The sound ray is invisible, inaudible, and fully controllable in respect to target, direction, and range. Its first public test, which you are about to witness, has been set to cover a small sector, a mere 2 miles, in perfect safety, with all space cleared for 20 miles beyond. The present generating equipment in our laboratory is capable of producing rays to cover, through the outlets which you may observe under the dome, the entire countryside within a radius of 100 miles, a circle with a periphery extending from the shore of the Mississippi, roughly from the bridge of the Taggart Transcontinental Railroad, to Des Moines and Fort Dodge, Iowa, to Austin, Minnesota, to Woodman, Wisconsin, to Rock Island, Illinois. This is only a modest beginning. We possess the technical knowledge to build generators with a range of 200 and 300 miles. But due to the fact that we were unable to obtain in time a sufficient quantity of a highly heat-resistant metal, such as Reardon metal, we had to be satisfied with our present equipment and radius of control. In honor of our great executive, Mr. Thompson, under whose far-sighted administration the State Science Institute was granted the funds without which Project X would not have been possible, this great invention will henceforth be known as the Thompson Harmonizer.
The crowd applauded. Mr. Thompson sat motionless, with his face held self-consciously stiff. Dr. Stadler felt certain that this small-time shyster had had as little to do with the project as any of the movie usher attendants, that he possessed neither the mind nor the initiative, nor even the sufficient degree of malice
to cause a new gopher trap to be brought into the world, that he too was only the pawn of a silent machine, a machine that had no center, no leader, no direction, a machine that had not been set in motion by Dr. Ferris or Wesley Mooch, or any of the cowed creatures in the grandstands, or any of the creatures behind the scenes. An impersonal, unthinking, unembodied machine, of which none was the driver, and all were the pawns, each to the degree of his evil. Dr. Stadler gripped the edge of the bench. He felt a desire to leap to his feet and run.
As to the function and the purpose of the sound ray, I shall say nothing. I shall let it speak for itself. You will now see it work. When Dr. Blodgett pulls the levers of the xylophone, I suggest that you keep your eyes on the target, which is that farmhouse 2 miles away. There will be nothing else to see. The ray itself is invisible. It has long been conceded by all progressive thinkers that there are no entities, only actions, and no values, only consequences. Now, ladies and gentlemen, you will see the action and the consequences of the Thompson Harmonizer.
Dr. Ferris bowed, walked slowly away from the microphone, and came to take his seat on the bench beside Dr. Stadler. A youngish, fattish kind of man took his stand by the switchboard and raised his eyes expectantly toward Mr. Thompson. Mr. Thompson looked blankly bewildered for an instant, as if something had slipped his mind, until Wesley Mooch leaned over and whispered some word into his ear. "Contact," said Mr. Thompson loudly. Dr. Stadler could not bear to watch the graceful, undulating, effeminate motion of Dr. Blodgett's hand as it pulled the first lever of the switchboard, then the next. He raised his field glasses and looked at the farmhouse. In the instant when he focused his lens, a goat was pulling at its chain, reaching placidly for a tall, dry thistle. In the next instant, the goat rose into the air, upturned, its legs stretching upward and jerking, then fell into a gray pile made of 7 goats in convulsions. By the time Dr. Stadler believed it, the pile was motionless, except for 1 beast's leg sticking out of the mass, stiff as a rod and shaking as in a strong wind. The farmhouse tore into strips of clapboard and went down, followed by a geyser of the bricks of its chimney. The tractor vanished into a pancake. The water tower cracked, and its shreds hit the ground while its wheel was still describing a long curve through the air as of its own leisurely volition. The steel beams and girders of the solid new trestle collapsed like a structure of matchsticks under the breath of a sigh. It was so swift, so uncontested, so simple, that Dr. Stadler felt no horror. He felt nothing. It was not the reality he had known. It was the realm of a child's nightmare where material objects could be dissolved by means of a single malevolent wish. He moved the field glasses from his eyes. He was looking at an empty prairie. There was no farm. There was nothing in the distance except a darkish strip that looked like the shadow of a cloud. A single high, thin scream rose from the tiers behind him as some women fainted. He wondered why she should scream so long after the fact. And then he realized that the time elapsed since the touch of the first lever was not a full minute. He raised his field glasses again, almost as if he were suddenly hoping that the cloud shadow would be all he would see. But the material objects were still there. They were a mount of refuse. He moved his glasses over the wreckage. In a moment he realized that he was looking for the kid. He could not find it. There was nothing but a pile of gray fur. When he lowered the glasses and turned, he found Dr. Ferris looking at him. He felt certain that through the whole of the test, it was not the target, it was his face that Ferris had watched, as if to see whether he, Robert Stadler, could withstand the ray.